welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of The Other Identity, and a happy holidays to everyone out there. Bringing in the new year, hopefully, with our beautiful voices. I am, of course, one of your hosts, Robbie Landis, and along with me, as always, Ben Morris. Ben, how's it going?
Hello, Robbie. Doing real great over here. Really enjoying the holiday season with my family and my friends, and I hope that you're doing the same. I hope you got everything you were looking for. I'm staring right now at the beautiful tome, X-Men, The Art and Making of the Animated Series, which I was gifted for Christmas, and nice. I'm excited to crack into it. I anyone who follows me on social media already knows that I basically told the story of my marriage in the sense that my wife got a new Dyson vacuum and was overjoyed. I, of course, got a comic book art book and was equally excited. There's a clear delineation of who the adult in this relationship is.
Yep. See, and now I know that both of us have been reading a lot of stuff pertaining to shows we're going to do. So that's actually what I was going to ask you, you know, sort of as a way to have a bit of a Christmas or a holiday episode was what your favorite gift was. Mine is actually very similar. Katie, my girlfriend, actually got me The Chronicles of Exandria, which is essentially this gigantic collection, special edition collection from Critical Role, the tabletop RPG game for Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, yeah.
That all the voice actors do. So it comes with like a, gosh, there must be like 300 pages of like art in there. And then it comes with a lot of like cool collectible things. Like there's some pressed flowers that one of the characters in the game keeps in her journal. There's a pamphlet to one of the characters' fake gods that they make up that's sort of in there. Just like all these cool little collectible things. It's the coolest thing, and I want to frame like all of it. But
that sounds super neat, and I think it's also cool that given that both of us have gotten so involved with digital streaming stuff, like mm-hmm. I feel like I'm reading all my comics digitally at this point. It's cool on both our ends to have something like physical that we can actually, you know, put on a shelf, pull out and hold for a little while. That's kind of neat.
Speaking of digital, before we get into today's episode, because we're going to get into it really, really quick because we have an amazing, high-profile special guest today.
Yes,
But I finished up Empire, which I know you still have a few issues to go, which we're going to talk about in a future episode here. But Kelly Thompson's Captain Marvel once again has like wowed me and made me fall in love with her characters and the way that she writes them. So I'm like, that's it. I'm getting back into Captain Marvel now. And so
You're binging it.
Yeah, I found where I had left off, and basically I had left off one issue before Empire started. So I read that issue. I jumped to after Empire, and none of those are on Marvel Unlimited.
Well, dude, at this point, look, Marvel Unlimited is only like 3 months behind.
That's fair.
So you can't really fault them that much.
I know,
but I've been diving into Kelly's Captain Marvel as well. I'm actually in the last Avenger arc right now. I jumped ahead and read the entire stuff.
Oh, good.
Which, by the way, guys, if you want to be involved in our Empire episode, go on Twitter, use the hashtag Empire Reading Challenge. That's Empire with a Y. Don't ask. But we are discussing. You're discussing. I'm just posting art because I want to save all my commentary for the for the show. But if you guys want to join in, we want to know your thoughts as well. But as far as Kelly's Captain Marvel, I'm not going to totally repeat what I said last time, but she really is making me fall in love with Carol Danvers in a way I haven't since she was Miss Marvel. I when she made the transition to Captain Marvel, I didn't open on the show about it. It took me a little while to warm up to it, even though I love the costume and I love the character. But Kelly's take is probably my favorite that I've read so far.
Well, coming up next, we have a special guest.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
Here on The Other Identity, so sit tight. We'll be right back.
Hey, what's up? It's James Campbell. Every week on Checkpoint XP On Demand, I'm joined by my co-hosts Weird Beard and Robbie Landis as we bring you a layman's perspective on all things esports and gaming. So whether it's the latest in Overwatch, Ninja doing something crazy, or a Mario Battle Royale, we'll cover it. You can get it on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, I would like to thank you for joining us over your holiday break here, taking the time to download The Other Identity. And it's without further ado that I would like to introduce our guest today, a lifelong comic book fan and one of the most respected storytellers in the industry. Phil Jimenez published his first work on Wonder Woman in 1991 at the age of 21. In the three decades since, he has worked on nearly every major character at Marvel, as well as DC, including Batman, Spider-Man, the X-Men, and the Teen Titans. From 2001 to 2003, Phil compiled a celebrated tenure as both writer and artist of Wonder Woman. Phil, welcome to The Other Identity.
Thank you, Robbie. That was an amazing introduction, by the way.
Did we get it all right? That's what I'm most concerned about.
It was perfect, and it was amazing. I'm literally smiling ear to ear because it sounded great. It was perfect, and I'm horrified that it's been 30 years.
I'd love to also take credit for the fact that it was written, but unfortunately, Ben did write it. I only read it, which, of course, you know, is where I think all the oomph comes from.
No. The reading was everything.
I agree.
You could have, completely lied about everything. The reading was terrific. Anyway, thank you very, very much. Yes, it was a terrific opening, and I am literally smiling because I can't believe it's been 30 years.
I was saying before we started recording, Phil is one of my oldest friends in comics. He'll hate that I say this, but I was a fan in the 90s as a kid, but then I got to meet him once I was actually working, and it was one of those, you know, they always say don't meet your heroes because they won't live up to expectations. Phil has been nothing but amazing to me in comics, in life, in general, just a wonderful mentor, friend, and just one of the best. I mean, when we said we were doing a Wonder Woman episode, I was like, we need to try to get Phil, because when I think of Wonder Woman, you are somewhere George Perez is feeling like an itch the back of his head, but you're the guy. You're the guy I associate with Wonder Woman.
Excuse me. Yes, you should always associate George Perez with Wonder Woman. And I say that legitimately because I would have no career on Wonder Woman if it wasn't for George Perez and the work he did revamping that character in the 80s. And it's interesting as a quick sidebar, because I was reviewing some things I'd written about Wonder Woman over the years. And I always think that they're essentially, until probably the past 10 years, there are two main influencers, on maybe three, on how we perceive Wonder Woman in the comics. And the first is the original. It's Charles Moulton, like William Moulton Marston, the guy that created her, and then George Perez. And I get a little worried that George sometimes gets lost in the shuffle. I don't know if that's actually true. I don't know how many people, new readers or fans of the movies, really understand how much of what they're seeing comes from George, right? And so, I always do hope that he gets his respect, particularly as it relates to this character, because I really think his take on her changed her in the industry for the last 35 years.
So let's jump into it then. Let's talk about, obviously, Perez was a huge influence on you, but where did you first encounter Wonder Woman, not as a professional, because like we said, you drew her first back in the 90s on War of the Gods. But as a fan, was it comics? Was it the TV show? Like, what was your gateway to the character?
So this dates me, so forgive me. But I've told the story a lot, but I still think it's funny. I was a TV kid, not a comic book kid. And so I actually think my gateway into superheroes, particularly DC superheroes, was through TV. So the Super Friends cartoon particularly, and then of course the Wonder Woman TV show with Linda Carter. And I was five, I think, when that show came out. And if you guys must know, especially with kids, that there's this magic moment where a kid will connect with something and it will change their life forever, right? You will be a fan forever. And for me, I have to say that the timing of Linda Carter's Wonder Woman, there was something about it in my life that changed forever. And I've clearly done a lot of thinking about it over the years about what it was specifically. But I would say my gateway to that character was the Wonder Woman TV show, which coincided also with the Super Friends. and Wonder Woman's character. So to see her in two incarnations, like in a cartoon and a live action, was amazing to me. And then, of course, I think as a kid, I was drawn to specifically the Greek mythology aspect of the character, the weird and sort of, I would say, honestly, like the glittery, shiny costume. And it cannot be expressed enough. Like, I just think Linda Carter's physical beauty was so, I was mesmerized by her. So much so that the show itself, like the particulars of the episodes, which were not always great, kind of vanished because she was just this presence. And so I think I owe Hanna-Barbera and Linda Carter my career, basically.
You know, that's really interesting that the TV version of Wonder Woman, you know, Linda Carter's Wonder Woman, is where you sort of got your start or where your interest in comics began. Because, you know, for me, really it was only this past year, starting this show with Ben, that I really started reading comics as heavily as I did. But I've always been a superhero fan. And before the MCU for me, growing up, it was Batman the Animated Series. It was X-Men the Animated Series. You know, Spider-Man, you know, back in the early 90s. Those are sort of what made me fall in love, you know, with superheroes.
Yeah, well, what's amazing about those animated shows, again, forgive if this diverges, is a lot of the writers in the 90s that I know, a lot of creators, got into comics because of the X-Men show in the 90s and the Batman cartoon in the 90s. And the profound effect that they've had on, like, at least a generation of comic creators and the way they think about those characters. And I mean, I think it's actually really amazing. And I do think it's sort of the reason those televised versions matter, just because of reach, of course. But they turned a lot of young people into fans and then creators.
As a huge, huge fan of, like, X-Men the Animated Series, for example, you know, I will never stop singing the praises of someone like Kelly Thompson, who's, you know, Gambit and Rogue in Mr. and Mrs. X, for example. It's like they jumped right off the screen and into those comic pages, and to see them, you know, continue to live on even years after, you know, the animated series has ended as a fan is, you know, phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually really great. And, I will say, I think, again, I cite the X-Men cartoon and the Batman cartoon as, I think, two kind of exemplary, it's two perfect examples of cartoons that get people into comics. But the other, I will say, in the 80s, we were pretty lucky, too, in that we had, like, Spider-Man and his Amazing Friends. There was a lot of heroic action-adventure stuff. It was clearly less sophisticated, but there was a ton of it. And the one thing that they had, which I always say helps, is really terrific voice actors. So even if the plots were kind of nonsensical, the characters were sort of rich and inhabited and, like, present all the time. And so, again, like, I would watch Saturday morning cartoons until there were none left. And then you were in some weird live action thing. And then, like, it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon and I finally had to clean my bedroom or something. But going back to my love for Wonder Woman, it's absolutely born of TV. The one other thing bit I like to throw out is Superman and Wonder Woman appeared in a cartoon about the Brady Bunch kids, which I don't know if you've ever heard of. You can YouTube it. It's called the Brady Kids. And Superman and Wonder Woman each made an appearance on that cartoon. And I have memories of that Wonder Woman appearance on this show, which was like maybe... It must have been a repeat. It might have been created, like, before I would have been too young to remember it. But again, the power of that costume, whatever that look was, the connections to the sort of Greek mythology, all that stuff, like, resonated with me as a kid, and it's just stuck with me literally my whole life.
Well, kind of riffing off of that, aside from the visual and aside from the Greek mythology connection, what, both as a fan, as a creator, what's kind of the core of Diana's character to you? Like, what are the things that you, obviously people do different takes on it. We've seen a lot in the last 20 years,
sure,
people like stretching and going in different directions. But for you, what's that, like, consistent, this needs to be there as far as the character of Wonder Woman?
So it's interesting. I've done, if this gets too jargony, let me know. I've done a lot of actually academic writing on this the past few years, and it's been super interesting. When I was a kid, and I still think it's a through line, and I've talked about this before, there were several things. So I was a young closeted gay kid, and Wonder Woman and then the Bionic Woman were two examples of, I think, strong, and I mean physically strong, feminine characters who were the objects of desire by men. So I think that's a big part of it. But were also, believe it or not, this is going to sound crazy, but they were not militarized, right? Like, they were not like soldiers. They were human beings as embodied by those actors. But there was this overriding sense, particularly in the Wonder Woman TV show, and particularly that first season, that, and it sounds super corny, but I think in this day and age, it's actually really still important. Love saves the day. Peace is something worth fighting for. Particularly the first season of Wonder Woman, even still, it's a proto-feminist show. So it's kind of funny to see her deal with like some of the BS, like 70s chauvinism, right? Which probably still exists today. But, you know, Linda Carter was always kind of rolling her eyes about it. So I would say the qualities beyond the visual had a lot to do with what were inherent, which were important to me. There was a certain humanity to them. They were not dark Avengers of the night. They were good people doing good things. The actors, what I appreciate is they could be exasperated by the foolishness of the outside world, right? Like, which I really appreciated. But I think at the end of the day, the fact that love was their guide meant a lot to me.
You know, over the past year, I've been learning a lot more about Wonder Woman, you know, just as a character. I've obviously, you know, prior to even reading the comics, you know, I had seen the movie and, you know, sort of the bare minimum stuff. You know, I knew who Wonder Woman was, but it's just recently I've really started to learn exactly what her sort of core is. And obviously I've been doing that through the Rebirth series, but I think the story for me that best encapsulates Wonder Woman, you know, and to your points about stuff like, you know, life and love and liberty and stuff like that, is actually from the Blackest Night storyline, where she wields the Star Sapphire ring. And, you know, seeing her interactions, you know, through that, and like, you know, with Mira when they're fighting, and just to know that sort of at her core, like, even though she's a warrior, that it's all about preserving life and it's about preserving love. You know, a lot of times I tend to compare Thor and Wonder Woman, right? Because they sort of both come from that mythological, you know, background of the gods. And so obviously they're both warriors, but they're very different in the way that they go about it. You know, Thor, if you need to throw down, if you know, you're having a drink and it's about honor, whatever, but if it comes down to battle and there's a fight, you know, somebody dies. But, you know, Diana, I feel like, because at her core it's about stuff like liberty, love, and life, you know, that the end result of a battle, even though you're warriors, even though you've been bred for war, it doesn't have to be death.
I think at her best, that's part of her core, though it's not always played. It's so funny that the Wonder Woman Thor thing is quite common. I tend to actually relate Wonder Woman to Captain America more than Thor, in terms of both sort of idealized versions of who they are, fish out of water, fish out of time, right? Like, really, Captain America is thrust forward from World War II. He's just a noble guy. I don't necessarily see Wonder Woman as like so, I'm going to say, uptight, for lack of a better word, right? Like, I think she's actually a more fun character. And in that way, probably has a lot, is maybe more like Thor. But generally, I think in terms of nobility and sort of a worldview, I tend to relate her more to Captain America than I do to Thor. But that's just me. It's interesting, I was thinking about this a lot, and I'm going to snake through some stuff, but Wonder Woman is an interesting example. I talk about this a lot, of a female character that has written, so she'll be 80 next year. She's been around for 80 years, for most of her career by men, including me, right? So most of Wonder Woman's career up until gosh, 90s, maybe the 2000s, Wonder Woman's adventures were always written by men. And the character was created inherently, and it's in her DNA to talk about two things, essentially, which are sex and gender, love, right, and all that kind of stuff, and war. So there are these two ideas that Wonder Woman explores naturally. And I think it's really interesting because it's all told through the lens of feminism. And that lens has always been explored creatively by men. So there have been women editors on Wonder Woman, and the guy that created Wonder Woman, his wife had a very heavy hand in her creation. But it's only been recently that we've actually started hearing and reading the voices of women interpret this character, who's essentially kind of like this perfect female ideal. And it's so interesting to me to see how her character changed decade by decade as men struggled to figure out women, including me. And then now you have women interpreting her, and it's like a whole new, it feels like a whole new ballgame. And so I'm always really fascinated, particularly how women interpret Wonder Woman, because some really like her, some really don't. A very interesting critique I heard of her early version was that in the 1940 stuff, which is bizarre, but fabulous. And I argue like so crazy forward thinking for its time, it's insane. Wonder Woman came to man's world and she didn't have an arc. She didn't have anything to learn. Because she knew who she was. She came to transform the world, not be transformed by it, right? Like she was, so when she showed up, it wasn't like she's like, oh, I wonder how all this works. She's like, I know how this works. Now it's my job to teach you. She was a highly assertive character. And there are very few of those in fiction. And then when George Perez took it over, she became a much more sort of naive waif from like a closed little world, like who'd never been at like, I always joke, it was like the girl from the small town who ended up in the big city, right? And so she brings some of her naivete and softens the people in the big city, but then she's transformed a little bit by what she sees. But I always thought it was very interesting that my friend had said was that it bothered her for a long time that she had no arc. And then she came to understand that that was the point. Wonder Woman didn't have anything to learn from us. We were supposed to learn from her. And I think that's a profound idea when you think that in the 1941, a comic book company was publishing a comic about a woman who is coming to teach our world how to do things right. Like, I just think that's mind blowing in its way.
So one thing we like to try to do on this show, Phil, is we try to appeal to both the diehards and also people who are coming in for the first time. So obviously with Wonder Woman 84 coming out, there's going to be a lot of people looking for Wonder Woman comics to kind of supplement what they've been doing. And as someone who has read and written and drawn Wonder Woman comics, what would you recommend if someone hops on DC Universe, either from your own stuff or from other people's, just to like get started? Just what's a good, like evergreen, this is not going to overwhelm you Wonder Woman story, or is it different for everybody?
So I think it's super different for everyone. So I actually had the good fortune to see Wonder Woman 84. And the thing, no spoilers, the thing I like about it, and it's, you can read this in reviews, but the first film is heavy. Like there's some gravitas to it. This one is a much lighter, fun film, which I think is perfect Wonder Woman. Because historically, if you look over her runs, they're either like super heavy and dark or kind of like bonkers, fun, ridiculous, right? Like the thing I like about that character so much is it runs... She runs an amazing gamut. You can have a million types of stories with her. So part of that will be like, if someone comes out of a movie theater, it's like, what do I want to, I want to read more about her. It depends on if they want kind of the fun version or the heavy gravitas version or all of it. This is so I do like to send people to the first couple of trades of the George Perez Wonder Woman, because that's kind of where this, even the film version has her roots. And it's serious and it's mythological. It's a little bombastic. It's a little 80s, but it's wonderfully plotted and it gives you all the information you need. And the artwork's really beautiful. I tend to actually like George's second year on the book more than I like the first, because once the origin stuff is done, like it's just, it's so much more, it feels less tight actually. But like, I would say the first couple of trades of the George Perez Wonder Woman was really, really good. A story that I really love because I think it's so crazy unique is Gail Simone's The Circle, which Terry Dodson drew, because it's this whole amazing take by a woman on Wonder Woman's birth story, which has been hyper-idealized. And this whole new take is one of my favorite Wonder Woman stories of all time. It's also only 4 issues, and you can buy it in a trade paperback. It's really easy and fun. It's really easy to read, and it's got fun elements, but it's also got some weight to it, which I really like. If you're into the retro stuff, I always think people are blown away by that mod Wonder Woman of the 1960s, right? Where she's basically Emma Peel. So I do like to direct people to some of those older trades from like, I'm trying to think of what it's called, if you go to a comic store or look on Amazon, you can get them, and you can see like this period of time when she had no powers and she was just like a secret agent spy, because it's so, so bizarre. And then I tend to recommend most things by Greg Rucka. I think the Rebirth Greg Rucka run is pretty amazing. And I think a lot of Wonder Woman 84 is sort of rooted in that. And the artwork's really beautiful. And I think it's a super modern take. So those are some examples. I tooting my own horn, if you can find, I think it's I forget if it's Paradise Lost or Paradise Found. I think it's Paradise Found, the trade. I wrote and drew a day in the life story of Wonder Woman, which is still considered one of the best stories ever, which I'm so grateful for. And Joe Kelly, who was writing Superman, helped me because Lois Lane is in the issue. And then there's the Our Worlds at War tie-ins, which I think are really good. So if you can find that trade, that's also, I think, really worth it. But I would start with the George Perez stuff. I think the Gail Simone, the Circle trade, some of the retro stuff, which is really, really fun. And then Rucka's Rebirth, is really terrific.
I'm going to echo Phil's sentiment there on Rebirth, the Rebirth era of Wonder Woman. It's currently what I'm reading through, and it is fantastic. Phil, thank you so much. It has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Coming up here next, Ben and I are going to talk a little bit about what we thought of Wonder Woman 1984, a sequel to Gal Gadot and Patty Jenkins.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
It's first Wonder Woman that's coming up here in just a minute, and you can watch it right now on HBO Max to avoid any possible spoilers.
College esports is still on the rise, so make sure you tune in to Checkpoint on Campus, the number one show for college esports. If you're still curious about some of the stories, like which college stars have made it to the LCS Proving Grounds, or what teams are dominating in CSL College, Checkpoint on Campus has the story for you. On BPod Studio, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts, and on YouTube.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. A big thank you once again to Phil for taking some time out of his holiday weekend, or his holiday week, to spend some time with us.
That was pretty awesome.
Wonder Woman. Yeah.
Phil's not only one of my favorite people in comics, and I say that both as a person and as a fan. He's really, as you got reading his introduction, he's a legend. I mean, he's been doing this for a long time. He's done all the top characters. So getting his insight on Wonder Woman, who I know is one of his favorite characters, was very cool.
So speaking of Wonder Woman, of course, it did debut last week on HBO Max. We've all hopefully had a chance to watch it. How do we want to go about this? Are we saying like no spoilers, light spoilers, or will there be spoilers here?
I think we should do light spoilers.
Okay.
You tell me what you can do, but I think I can talk about this movie with some light spoilers, but I don't need to go too in depth. But I do feel like some things need to be addressed.
All right.
And here's the place to do it.
Well, first of all, let's start. Ben, did you like Wonder Woman 1984?
My thoughts immediately coming out of it were, with this cast, there's no way they're going to make a bad movie,
mm-hmm.
because just those four principals between Gal Gadot, Chris Pine, Kristen Wiig, and probably especially for me, Pedro Pascal,
yes, yep.
Were all, they're so good that you could have a pretty lousy movie and they'd still elevate it to being decent.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I do think that's kind of the case here. I didn't hate it. I didn't like it as much as the original, and I have some serious problems with it, which I'm sure we can get into. So I would put myself firmly in the middle. I went on Twitter and saw people either saying this is the greatest movie of all time or this is the worst movie of all time. I don't think it's either of those things.
Oh, come on. Did none of you watch Batman vs. Superman?
See, there you go. So this is certainly somewhere in the middle for me, and definitely not up to the level of the original Wonder Woman, which I think you echo.
Yes, I agree with a lot of that. So it'll be interesting to see where our opinions on it land. Speaking of Batman versus Superman and Justice League Snyder Cut, I actually had a bunch of Snyder fanboys come after me on Twitter over the weekend.
That's always fun.
Yeah, yeah. So that was
you know what? You should wear that as a badge of honor.
Oh, I do. Absolutely.
Yeah, that means you're one of the more rational comics critics on the internet.
All right, so let's talk about it then. What is it? Because I agree with you. First of all, they had an absolutely star-studded cast, and mm-hmm. given the material that they had, and obviously under the supervision of Patty Jenkins, yes, I thought that they all did phenomenal. The only issues that I would have had with any of the actors or how they portrayed would have came down, I think, to the writing or maybe not having enough screen time. Pedro Pascal, as Callie said on Twitter, you know, you can basically watch him just completely chew up the scenery all day
long. He was my favorite by far.
Yeah.
By far.
Not what I expected out of Maxwell Lord, given the experiences that I've had with him in the comics.
Sure. It was a very different take, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah, but I think the what I had sort of came down to it was, is this movie, especially compared to the first one, and I think compared to good comic book movies, it didn't seem like it was very concise in what it
Not
wanted to do or say.
No, it was kind of all over the place. And I'll say, honestly, my biggest issue with it beyond that, because I think you nailed it, it's just a movie that just like wanders and wanders and wanders rather than getting to the point. Mm-hmm. But my biggest issue with it was, for a Wonder Woman movie, there just wasn't enough Wonder Woman. And this is something I've seen before in superhero sequels. I actually draw it directly to Iron Man 2, Batman Returns. These are not bad movies, but it's always like, all right, we established the origin and we really focused on our main character in the first movie. So let's bring in a bunch of fancy new toys for the second one and kind of give them the stage. And for me, I felt like this movie was very much Max's story. To a lesser extent, it was Barbara's story. To some extent, it was even Steve's story. It never felt like it was Diana's story. Like, she felt like a supporting character at best. And I have said before, I love Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm going to see a Wonder Woman movie, I want Diana more front and center. That was my only problem with the original, was I didn't like that it ended with Steve essentially being the pivotal hero.
Yeah.
And this one, again, I don't want to get into it because we said we'd only do light spoilers, but I hate the resolution of the main plot. Like, I hate the way
I agree. You know, a lot of people complained about the first one, the final act not really having that great of a fight scene. And while there was a scuffle between Diana and Cheetah at the end there,
which was good, that was good.
I still kind of felt the same way. Like the resolution to it still, I don't think, lived up to what is possible for Wonder Woman and what we've seen before in comic book movies.
Right.
I'm going to agree with you, though. Wonder Woman Diana definitely needed way more screen time. And I also agree that I think, once again, Chris Pine's Trevor, I think that he was sort of the reason for it. Well, I thought that the way that they brought him back was unique, and mm-hmm. I accepted. Like, all right, sure, that's fine. I don't think that they needed to. I hate seeing Diana being the, oh, you know, what was me? I just want love. Why can't I just have this one?
Well, you know what's even worse about that, though, is that when you consider the in-between movies, this is how she's been for the past 40 years.
Like,
she's literally spent 40 years pining over this guy who, realistically,
has it not been longer
like
than
week
that?
Well, it was World War II. The first one was in World War II. So
I thought it was World War I for some reason.
No. Okay, so that was around the 40s,
yes.
Which means this is about 40 years yep. later. And it means that, I mean, really, she met this guy for, at best, a couple weeks. and now she spent the last 40 years basically putting her life on hold because he's gone. I don't think either you or I like the Diana Steve Trevor relationship that much. And I love Chris Pine. He's great. But that was almost a problem because
it was set in World War One, by the way.
Oh, it's in World War One. Yeah. So even longer.
So it's been like 80 longer. Years.
Oh, Jesus. So that's even worse. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a lot.
Well, and here's the thing too. If they wanted to have like another moment where Diana has to give up someone that she loves, in the comics, her relationship to Dr. Minerva goes a lot further than just like, oh, yeah, you know, we were kind of friends at work, right? I think
that annoyed me too.
See, I think that if they would have completely left Steve Trevor out of it and focused more on Dr. Minerva falling to this curse,
yeah,
that and have sort of the central struggle for Diana being, I want to save my friend. I don't want to see another friend of mine fall victim to something, refusing to fire until like, you know, sort of like the final end, and really showing a struggle there between, you know, two women who have these strong feelings for each other. I think that could have been phenomenal.
Yes, that would have been much more interesting. And they also did the thing that I hate in these movies where it's literally Diana and Barbara have one scene together where they're out to dinner, and now it's like, well, oh no, it's my friend, you know, like the whole like, yeah, I can't believe my friend is turning against me. Like, guys, you met yesterday. Like, in the course of this movie, you've spent one meal and one evening together. Like, let's see them really build this relationship. I don't know. I know it's a problem because it's a movie and you only have 2 hours and you can't, you know, do that much time. But I that always bothers me. I will say that when they did do action scenes, they were a lot of fun.
Oh, the stuff in the White House was great.
I love the lasso work. I love all of that. And I actually really like that opening sequence from the contest, mm-hmm. the flashback that has Robin Wright and Connie Nielsen in it. But that's another issue, is there wasn't enough action. The action scenes were very far and few between. Like, she's barely in costume.
Yeah, and the other thing that I'll mention too, since you mentioned how great the lasso looked, when it comes to special effects, I think the lasso was one of the only ones that I really liked. You know, whenever it showed her flying or whenever she was running next to stuff, the effects were a little shoddy for me.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, look, there's a lot to nitpick, but I think the biggest problems are definitely not enough Diana, not enough action, and let's just call a spade. The Steve stuff is problematic. I saw a lot of people on Twitter who are just like, and this will probably be our heaviest spoiler of the episode, they're like, they just couldn't get behind the fact that Diana knows that he has taken over this other guy's life, and that other guy has essentially ceased to exist.
Yeah.
And she's fine with it because she has her boyfriend back. And there was a lot of chatter about that's not how Wonder Woman would act.
Yeah.
And I kind of got to get on board with that.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think so overall, you know, within the pantheon of DC movies, where do you set this?
So it's not as good as the original Wonder Woman. It's better than the really bad ones, your Batman v Superman's, your Suicide Squad's,
Justice League.
And so I would put it somewhere around the middle. Well, I think Aquaman is better. Aquaman's definitely better. And then I haven't seen Shazam or Man of Steel. So to me, this is right in the middle of the pack. I have a sense I would obviously like Shazam more than I liked this.
Mm-hmm.
And Man of Steel is only the only outlier. So solidly in the middle for me.
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree. I think the few that I would put above it is obviously the first Wonder Woman, Shazam. I think you're right. I think Aquaman and this, probably depending on what you're looking for in a movie, may sort of be interchangeable. They're pretty close. I'd also put Birds of Prey above this.
I was just going to say, I just remembered Birds of Prey. Yeah. I probably like Birds of Prey better than this one.
Yeah. So by all stretches of the imagination, it's not a bad DC movie at all. And obviously there are still tons and tons of people that love this movie. So definitely looking forward.
And again, Robbie, just to close this out, there's a lot of things we nitpicked, but there was a reason I said straight at the beginning that you can't make a bad movie with those four people.
Absolutely.
Because the performances within a story that kind of let me down in some ways, the performances by the actors were still very top notch. And it's the kind of thing where I feel like that's almost the story of the DC extended universe. Everyone always says basically Henry Cavill's a great Superman who's never gotten to be in a good Superman movie. Mm-hmm. I think that's what we saw here. A bunch of actors who are really good at playing these parts and are just kind of trapped in a subpar movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one good thing to look forward to, and I forget exactly who it is that said it, if it was Patty Jenkins or if someone else who's working on the movies, but I'm pretty sure that at some point somebody said that the next Wonder Woman movie won't be in the past. It'll finally be caught up to modern times.
Right. And it's time for that, because the other thing is, besides the fact that I want to see her in the modern world, the more adventures you set in the past, the more you're straining the credibility of Batman didn't know she existed until the late, 2010s, mm-hmm. because she's just been operating in secret and he's the world's greatest detective. So we need to get her out in the public sooner rather than later.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, guys, that's going to be it for The Other Identity. So glad you decided to download us on your holiday week and spend a little bit of time with us. But remember, we'll be back here at same Other Identity channel, same Other Identity time.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.